Welcome. First, a bit of clinical news, the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch. And then we revisit an interview from just over a year ago on the apparently equal effectiveness of NPs, PAs, and MDs in managing diabetes in the primary care setting. Here's editor Amy Herman with the news.
Hi, everyone. First, researchers propose that looser criteria can be used to safely rule out pulmonary embolism without chest imaging in some patients, specifically if patients have a low clinical pretest probability of pulmonary embolism and a D-dimer level below 1,000, or if they have a moderate pretest probability and a D-dimer below 500, they don't need chest imaging to rule out the condition. In another study, a simple smoking cessation intervention improved quit rates among patients in the emergency department. Patients got brief advice about quitting that highlighted smoking's mortality risk, and they could choose their own quit schedule. The intervention took only a minute and cost just an additional 47 cents per patient. Next, a large study finds that non-HDL cholesterol is strongly linked to first cardiovascular events. The good news? Treating high levels early in life, for example, before age 45, may greatly reduce a patient's later risk. Elsewhere, a study links use of permanent hair dyes and chemical straighteners to increased risk for breast cancer. Just note that it was an observational study among women who had at least one sister who'd been diagnosed with breast cancer already. And finally, researchers report on the first case of so-called cobalt lung associated with vaping. A woman developed giant cell interstitial pneumonia after 6 months of vaping cannabis. She improved with treatment, but 30 months after diagnosis, her lung function was still impaired. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's Clinical Conversation next.
This is Clinical Conversations. The Annals of Internal Medicine published a study examining the question, what are the intermediate-term outcomes of diabetes care, provided by three classes of practitioners, physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. The researchers went to great pains to eliminate bias in their results, and we're fortunate to have the study's lead author, Dr. George L. Jackson, and the senior author, Dr. Perry Morgan, as our guests. Dr. Jackson is a research health scientist and director of the Implementation and Improvement Science Lab in the Center of Innovation to Accelerate Discovery and Practice Transformation, also called ADAPT, at the Durham, North Carolina VA Healthcare System. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Division of General Internal Medicine at Duke University. Dr. Morgan is a practicing PA and professor in the Physician Assistant Program at Duke University, where she directs the research program. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Jackson and Dr. Morgan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Let me try to summarize your design. You examined the electronic records of some 370,000 VA patients with diabetes from over 550 facilities across the country during a two-year treatment span. Clinical measures of diabetes control during the second of those 2 years were compared according to the classification of their primary care provider, the clinician they saw most often. The measures of control included hemoglobin A1C, systolic blood pressure, and low-density lipoprotein. Is that accurate so far?
Absolutely.
Okay. Then, keeping the numbers to a minimum, tell us what you found.
Well, we found that there were no clinically significant differences in blood sugar control, blood pressure control, or cholesterol control among patients with pharmaceutically treated diabetes who were seen by a PA, NP, or physician primary care providers.
And so you defined those primary care providers in a rather strict way. First of all, If it was clear that the care was under the control of a resident in the program, you didn't include that patient. You wanted seasoned physicians who were the people who most often saw the patient whose data were being collected. Is that right?
That's right. Our concern was that it's hard to know who has primary responsibility for or treating a patient when they're in a resident attending relationship. However, we were interested in the provider who most frequently saw the patient, so that they most frequently saw that person and during both the first year of the study and the second year of the study, so that there'd be an opportunity for that provider to have an impact on intermediate outcomes for patients with diabetes.
Okay. Yes, go ahead, Dr. Morgan.
We felt that it was really important to define the primary care provider as the patient, as the provider who most often saw the patient, because we've seen in other settings in our other research that sometimes organizations will assign a primary care provider to a patient, but that might not be who the patient ends up actually sort of sticking with. So we wanted to use the on the ground, you know, who actually saw this patient the most over the course of these 2 years. And we were interested to see that the primary care providers saw the patients for an average of about 75% of their visits. So they were truly primary, we think.
Okay. And so these patients, the data were, the patients were, their records over a two-year treatment span were collected. And you used the data from the second year. Now, did you compare it with the data in the first year?
We didn't specifically look at data from the first year. Our notion was that we wanted to make sure that there was a temporal relationship between, in this case, what we would call the exposure or the type of primary care provider that was seen by the patient, and all of the factors that we took into account to try to ensure that that the patients that are seen by NPs, PAs, and physicians in the study are comparable.
Okay.
So we wanted that to be from the first year and the outcome to be from the second year to ensure that temporal relationship.
Okay. So when you looked at that second year data, you looked at it in aggregate. In other words, what you did is you averaged in all the systolic pressures, say, from the second year. And then you said, how does this average compare with the average of patients seen by NPs? And how does it compare with the average of those in patients seen by PAs and physicians? Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
The reason we did that is because, for example, blood pressure may vary from visit to visit for a wide variety of reasons, so that we wanted to look at the average blood pressure, for instance, over the course of a year to be able to see if there's that level of what that level of control looks like.
And so you did that as well with hemoglobin A1C and low density lipoprotein.
That's correct.
Okay, good. So you went to some trouble to keep the as I was reading your paper, I was kind of in amazement at the way at the extent to which you tried to keep the sources of confounding to a minimum. And you've mentioned a few ways that you've done this. Did your statistician colleagues, were they impressed with this? Did they give you a clean bill of health and say, yeah, these data should really mean something?
Absolutely. One of the things about this kind of work is this is really a team sport, this research. So we had clinical expertise representing all the professions involved. We have epidemiologic expertise. We have an expert set of statisticians, and we did want to look at this work here and really take into account the potential that we would that any differences that could have been seen might have been the result of differences in patients.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, these same results hold when we did not take any of this into account. So when we had what we would call an unadjusted analysis,
mm-hmm.
we didn't see differences. We also didn't see differences when we only looked at patients on insulin versus and patients not on insulin. We also didn't see clinically significant differences when we looked at patients who based on their risk scores were very sick versus patients who weren't very sick. So no matter how we slice these data, we were not seeing any clinically significant differences in these intermediate diabetes outcomes between the patients of NPs, PAs, and physicians.
Okay, and you call them intermediate outcomes because these patients were only observed over this 2 year span.
Well, we talk about those because we weren't looking at whether they had heart attacks or whether or not they had microvascular complications like blindness.
Okay.
But all of these outcomes are associated with those sort of downstream outcomes.
All right.
So it's a way to be able to look at things over, you know, a shorter period of time.
And what surprised you, Dr. Morgan, what surprised you about the finding?
Truthfully, I wasn't. These findings are really in line with other studies that have been done before in smaller samples, but in many studies, the quality of care has typically been comparable amongst the providers. We felt that this was an opportunity to improve on the methods of other studies because we had this large data set in the VA and were able to control for a number of problems that have arisen in a lot of the other studies that have been done.
Okay.
So we're really fortunate to have a really robust electronic health record in the VA. And we've had that for many years, which allows us to do some important things. One is we can tell the provider who is actually seeing in the patient when at an encounter. And then we can tell what is the profession of that provider. In some other data sets, like Medicare claims data, for example, it may be difficult to tell who actually saw the patient. For example, nurse practitioners and physician assistants may do something that they call incident to billing, or they bill under or a physician provider. And that's actually quite common in Medicare, for example. So when we look at, if we were to look at those data, we might not know who's actually providing the care. And those providers do that, and it's perfectly legal. It's very appropriate for them to do that, but it makes doing this kind of study more difficult. So in the VA, we know who's seeing the patient. We have a lot of information on those patients, like height and weight, and whether or not they're homeless, whether or not they're married, the distance that they have to travel to their provider, and we were able to take all of that into account. So we're able to use that data, and then we did, in fact, as you said earlier, do some sort of pretty sophisticated statistics and something called propensity score analysis. And we were able to then try to see, are these patients that are seen in this study, are they in fact comparable? And they are. But as we said earlier, the reality is, no matter how we slice these data, we did not observe clinically significant differences. The other piece we were able to do was, before we even looked at the data, we defined ahead of time what was clinically significant.
Yes.
And we did this to avoid having any biases, so that we would go back and look and say, was that really clinically significant? And the reason we did that is, when you have studies that have almost 370,000 people, very tiny differences can be what we would term statistically significant.
Yes.
But it may be that those statistically significant differences don't make any difference. So we determined that ahead of time, and we then were able to look and see if we had clinically significant differences.
Yes, and as I recall, now I haven't read the paper in a few days, you did find one or two mathematically, that is to say statistically significant differences, but when you say, all right, so are these differences clinically significant? The answer was no.
Absolutely. And that's really important, because while we certainly value the importance of things, whether or not things are statistically significant or not, and that is important in science, the reality is, again, when you have huge numbers of people represented in your data set, you don't want to take something that's statistically significant and put too much weight behind it. But it's important in this case to think about that ahead of time, which we did.
Now, what have you heard from your colleagues about this paper? Have you had any reactions? Anyone stop you in the corridor? Or
I think we get a couple of reactions. You know, one of the questions that we get from a lot of providers as well, were NPs and PAs just sending patients to endocrinology more frequently? And we were able to look at that in this paper. And the short answer is no. Mm-hmm. There weren't any important differences in the rates at which NPs, PAs, and physicians were sending patients to endocrinology or other specialty diabetes services in the VA.
Yeah.
So we were able to address that. But I think generally we've gotten pretty positive feedback on this, and people say that this – generally people do say this makes sense. And Perry?
I agree. One of the other questions or responses that we get is that even though people may not be surprised to see these intermediate diabetes outcomes similar across provider types, some people are skeptical about whether PAs and NPs might practice in some way that's less efficient, meaning they might need to see the patients more often in order to get the same outcomes, or they might do other kinds of referrals to specialists, or in some way cost the system more over the long run, even though their salaries are lower. So we get asked that question frequently, and we have, that's actually the next study that we're working on that's coming down the pipeline, is to use the same group of patients and compare the efficiency, meaning how much healthcare services are utilized by each provider type and what the overall cost of care is. So we're excited about that work coming up.
There was an intriguing editorial accompanying your paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and my favorite line was, well, first of all, I guess I had two favorite lines. They were both in the same paragraph. At the beginning of this paragraph, concluding the editorial, she said that it was time to embrace a variety of approaches to primary care. And then at the end, she says, it's time to end the practice of calling NPs and PAs mid-level providers. And I could imagine that your erstwhile mid-level provider colleagues must have cheered to see that.
Yeah, for two reasons. One, because she said it, and second, because she called out the term mid-level providers, which most of us aren't real fond of.
Yeah, I can imagine you not. So let me ask you both, what do you hope that the U.S. healthcare system will do with these findings?
One of the issues that often comes up is a concern about the potential shortage of primary care physicians. And one of the important pieces here is that there has still been debate over whether or not it's appropriate for NPs and PAs to be in that primary care provider role. And diabetes is a complex condition. It requires a lot of medical management, drugs and insulin and other things, but it's also a complex psychosocial condition. And so providers have got to work with their patients on how do they manage the condition themselves. So we're excited that for very complex patients, there appears to be equivalent intermediate outcomes. So it really does appear to be very reasonable to have NP and PA primary care providers. And of course, the reality is that this is already happening, that about half of people who have a regular provider at some point in a year see an NP or a PA, about a third of visits to in both the VA and community health centers or to PA or to an MP. So this is happening. And the good thing is that it increases, hopefully, people's comfort level with that.
And Dr. Morgan, do you have any thoughts on what you'd like to see happen as a result of this research?
Well, I think it does answer some questions that leaders and organizations might have about whether it is, as George alluded to, safe to have PAs and MPs be the primary, or they be the lead of the team, the primary care provider for complex patients.
Yes.
And I think we've shown in a very large sample that's certainly the case, because that is a that question about the role of PAs and NPs and what is appropriate still persists, and this may help to answer that. So some people feel that PAs and NPs should only take care of the least complicated patients, for example. Some organizations may not even let PAs or NPs be a primary care provider. Instead, they relegate them to roles supporting physician primary care provider. So this sort of, I think, validates this end of the spectrum of roles of the primary care provider being appropriate for PAs and NPs, even with complex patients and even with chronic disease.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today, Dr. Jackson and Dr. Morgan.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.